With that, we're going to move into our next presentation from Kara Pike. Kara is the founder and director of the Social Capital Project and Climate Alliance. Climate Access. Her work has resulted in the creation of the Ecological Roadmap, a segmentation study of the U.S. Public based on social values, Climate Crossroads, a research-based framing guide, Climate Communications and Behavior Change, a guide for practitioners, and most recently, American Climate Attitudes. Kara was formerly the Vice President of Communications for the leading nonprofit environmental law firm Earth Justice, created and ran a full-service internal communications agency for the organization's 8 offices, policy arm, and international program. With a Master's of Science in Environmental Communications from California University and a Bachelor's in Film and Communications and Environmental Science from McGill, Kara has a deep understanding of environmental issues and how they intersect with cultural trends and concerns. She speaks regularly on green marketing and social change and contributed to Strategies for the Green Economy, which was published by McGraw-Hill. Kara was a founding board member of the Global Footprint Network. She is a member of David Suzuki's Stonehouse Standing Circle, and she serves on the boards of Resource Media and the Hollyhock Educational Foundation, and she's a senior fellow at Willamette University Center for Sustainable Communities. So with that, I'll turn it over to Kara.
Thank you so much, Emma, and thanks for having me be part of the webinar today, and I'm excited to build on a lot of what Liz just presented by focusing in on where Americans are at with climate change, what some of those barriers are to action that Liz mentioned, how we can use communication to promote behavior change and action, and some outreach tips. Let me first start, though, with a quick overview of the Social Capital Project. We are part of the Resource Innovation Group, and we do a mix of research, training, and consulting on outreach strategy design. And as Emma mentioned, we also run the Climate Access Network, which is a problem-solving and resource-sharing community for folks like all of us who are trying to build public support for climate and sustainability policies and behavior change programs. So if you haven't checked it out yet, I encourage you to do so and join us in an ongoing conversation about what works and what doesn't work. So as mentioned, I want to start off today by talking a little bit about where the public is at on climate change from a big picture perspective. A lot of what we do is to look across numerous polls over the long term to really see where have we moved the public over time and where might there be some strategic opportunities. And one of the things that we've been tracking for a while is that there really is majority acceptance of the challenge of climate change. And that has been consistent for quite some time. I think most people who follow the polls saw that there was a spike in awareness and acceptance in 2009 that started to decline into 2010, but that's largely rebounded. And even with that dip, we were still largely at majority level of acceptance. When it comes to concern, concern is not as high as acceptance, but nonetheless, we still have majorities of the public saying that they feel it's a significant issue. And also slightly below half saying that the impacts and effects have already begun now. So where are we then if we have overall acceptance and to some extent understanding and concern? Well, one indicator that has not changed since 1997, when most of the polls that have been run consistently on climate change opinion started, it's very much still at the bottom of the list compared to other issues, and that really has not seen much movement over all this time. So why is that? Why is it people now largely accept, they are concerned, they feel it is a reality, but they're just not prioritizing it? So there's a few reasons for this. The first one is that even though people do increasingly see that climate change is happening now, they still don't necessarily see that that's impacting them personally. It's impacting everyone else except, and still largely it is about nature, it is about the polar bear, it is about people in developing countries, not so much here in the U.S., not so much my own community, and then really not me at all. And that's quite natural that people do tend to discount their own risk in a situation as compared to others. But there's still some work to be done in terms of making impacts very tangible making them very current, very localized, but in doing so also recognizing some of what that opens up. And I'll get to that in a minute. Another major challenge, though, is what we call the climate cognition challenge. Climate disruption is really a complex and unprecedented risk, and still to this day, some of the basic mechanisms are understood. And I'm not suggesting that everyone needs a very high level of scientific literacy in order to get this. I think it is about back to that map that Liz showed earlier of connecting the dots, making sure that people understand the connections between climate disruption, the burning of fossil fuels, and how that relates to some of the changes in the weather patterns and extreme storms that we're increasingly seeing. We often don't actually help people make those connections and just assume understanding. And this is really not about dumbing down. This is really about just recognizing that most people aren't in the weeds on this issue. Unfortunately, we're also still in a context where the climate change debate is largely focused around scientific certainty. And do we know how good is the science, and do we know enough science? Do we have enough certainty to act? I'll get back to this later. But I think it's actually really important to start thinking about responding to climate disruption as a risk issue and a risk management issue, where actually uncertainty and the need to manage uncertainty is a reason to act, not to stall. Perhaps, though, one of the most important challenges why this issue is still not a high priority for people is what we call the climate efficacy gap. And when you look at research from the Six Americas as well as other studies, you can see that even among the people who actually accept and very much care and are concerned about the issue, the alarmed, you still have only 6% actually believing that there is a chance we will turn this ship around, that we actually have not the technology, that's not the issue, but actually the will, the political, cultural, and economic will to make the change necessary. So I think this really comes back to the issue of communication and behavior change. This isn't just about giving people more information. This is about motivating people, having them have a sense that actually change is possible, and they can be part of creating that. So I want to jump into that now and talk a little bit about how do you actually motivate change, and what is the direct connection between communication and some of the core mechanisms. So really, there's a lot of nuances you could get into, but you could boil the basic mechanisms of change down into 3 points. People have to feel tension. Often, when you bring up the point of how hopeless people feel, there's an immediate response to, well, let's shift everything to solutions and a positive story. And really, no, you need tension. People need to feel that there's a disconnect between the values that they hold, their worldview, their identity, and the current situation they are in or we are in as a larger culture. But creating that sense of tension, heightening that sense of tension, which is, I think, what we have been doing in climate outreach, isn't enough, and it actually can backfire if it's not paired with that sense of what's possible, that there is efficacy on a government level, on a community level, that business has a role, that individuals can do something, and that there actually is a sense of hope and a possible direction to take the concern and to work through that disconnect into another phase. But finally, in order to, it's not just about it's possible to create the change. Part of it is, what will the benefits be about creating that change? And typically, people need to feel there are 2 times the benefits from making a particular change as compared to the cost. Now, what I think is really interesting about those 3 basic mechanisms of behavior change is that they actually match up perfectly with 3 of the core elements of a good story or of narrative. Every story has a plot. It has characters. But the plot boils down to these 3 basic things. That there has to be a challenge. Again, that sense of tension. No one wants to read a book or watch a movie or read anything, really, if there isn't something that those characters, the actors, doesn't have to struggle with and overcome. But again, there needs to be a choice, because you just end up feeling a bit of angst if those actors never can win, can never get away from that challenge or overcome it. So there must be that choice moment, that moment where the actor decides that they're going to do something different and that it's possible to do so. And finally, the opportunity is that expression of the benefits. What will get better? How will our lives be different? And how will the very things that caused that tension in the first place be resolved? So it's really critical to think about narrative and its connection to behavior change, because I want to actually go back to a point that Liz made. Facts alone are not enough. They are very, very critical, but we've been very, very focused on information campaigns that don't necessarily think about how to embed those facts and values and how to convey them in ways that will really not just have people understand but decide to act. So there's quite a lot of research out there showing that, you know, the facts are important. People need to understand some of the basics of an issue. They need to understand why an issue is the way it is, what are some of the options for acting. But the motivation to act, which is the motivation to change, to either support a policy or get involved with something, is based on an emotional response. It is a values response. It is about why we must act. And fortunately, narrative works very, very well to convey values and the morality of why we must act. And when you can bring together the how with the why, you really can move to shared understanding. So I want to talk a little bit more about why this is important, because of, again, how change works and how to think about it on a systemic level. So often in our day-to-day work, and a lot of times in our public outreach efforts, we're responding to daily events and crises. And that only gets us so far. That's only part of what people really think about. It is the obvious things that people see because it is above the surface. But once you go down below the surface of the water and start to see what is underneath those events and what's causing those crises, you can start to see something different. And I want to go down the iceberg to systemic structures, which is a lot of times where we're all focused. It is going deeper, not just responding to daily crises, to think about changes to policies, to think about investment in infrastructure such as energy efficiency, new technologies, buying electric vehicles. Those changes are very important. But there are also softer shifts that need to happen as well around our norms and values because of the very reasons I just said. It's what motivates us to act. And that really gets into the realm of not just policies and infrastructure changes, but really looking at how do we shift some of the ways that we see ourselves in the world. How do we start to understand some of the automatic responses and thoughts people have, work within that, and understand that people's worldview, how they see themselves in the world, really does influence what they're willing to do in an engagement process. This what I'm showing you now are the 5D stages of change. So looking at behavior change, but within a sustainability context, and this is thanks to the work of my colleague Bob Dopelt, and very much builds on what Liz was showing you earlier with some of the steps of change and some of the steps in community-based social marketing. This lays it out in terms of an ordering sequence, though. What steps come first? And really, there are 5 key steps that people go through when they actually decide they might engage in change. So the first step, and this is often where people are, is they're disinterested. Maybe they've heard about climate disruption, but they're not yet acting yet. So there is a role, once again, for information, for that awareness building, but it's often not the first thing that comes, and it can't be alone. Typically, people need to be woken up. There needs to be a disturbance. Some of the extreme weather events are creating that for some people, but not for all. A lot of times those disturbances are negative, but it could be positive as well. It could be that someone's kid is getting really excited about going car-free, and that influences the whole family's decision-making. But it's not just about information. It's also about giving people those choices, which is building that sense of efficacy, understanding that there are options. It is about that emotional inspiration, the hope, the stories, the sharing of the values, and very much those peer-to-peer relationships that are so important for reinforcements. And I'm not going to go into detail on this because Liz did cover quite a few of the elements, but you can see common threads around the evaluating how you're doing in creating your change, making that commitment to change, which is often a public commitment or done within a peer group that you care very much about, so that there's accountability and following up, that you're connected with others who care about what you care about, to get support from them, to get inspiration, and to create new peer groups and identities that make it okay to actually start to care about something like climate change and reducing our energy use. And finally, you get into actually people starting to try out a new behavior. They maybe won't change everything at once, but they may try one thing, substituting one activity for another and building on that to the point that perhaps then they are ready to install that new furnace in their home, they're ready to put the solar panels on the roof, they're ready to buy that electric vehicle. And typically when you get into those structural changes, people don't undo them. And the final point, which I think is actually very hopeful about behavior change, once people get on the path and they are actually taking the steps and they are getting that positive reinforcement, they tend to like it. And they tend to move into the point then of being a real champion of the change, of defending it and inspiring people, other people within their networks, to get involved as well. And I do think we're at an interesting time with the evolution of networks, the evolution of communication technology, to really think in creative ways about how some of those peer-to-peer network opportunities can play out. But I want to go back a little bit to the communication-specific side of this and how to think about some of the ways to frame climate communications in ways that can help create some of those disturbances, help build that awareness, and start to connect with people to one another. So I think the first one is to really think about redefining environmental action. Oftentimes, we overwhelm people with a million little things that they can do in order to act on a concern that they have. But often, those are not reinforced in the ways that both Liz and I recommended. And often, those items don't seem big enough. And I think we've been very, very afraid to actually ask people to do something big, to even consider the role of sacrifice in our outreach strategies. But really, part of what motivates people is to feel that they have a big role in something, that there's actually something significant for them to do, particularly in the face of such a huge challenge like climate change. So I think there's a lot more we can do in actually asking people to do big things, not just, oh, it'll only take you a minute to send this online petition. There's actually more people are willing to do if they feel connected to others and inspired in that. One quick note, I think there's a really interesting campaign. A lot of you will be familiar of it because it was a partnership between an environmental organization and a number of city governments. But the Earth Hour City Challenge is a very interesting model where it really is, rather than a sort of pushing on leaders and being negative, encouraging leaders to race to the top, to be the most prepared city to respond to the changes in our climate and to reward them. And this campaign has a lot of the elements that Liz described in her presentation, such as creating incentives, recognizing leadership, doing that publicly, and they've had a lot of success with that to date as a result. I think it's also really critical to embrace diversity. As I mentioned, identities, values, and worldviews are critical to recognize in our communication strategies so we can motivate behavior change. And it's really important to recognize that a lot of people still don't see themselves in this picture. It has been framed, climate, to this point as typically an environmental challenge, which puts you in an identity category that is largely seen as older, white, highly educated urbanite professionals who drive Priuses and drink lattes. And that's not all bad. I'm not trying to make fun of that at all. But I'm just saying that a lot of people care about this issue from all walks of life, and the more we incorporate those different identities, the different ways of connecting to the environment, connecting to climate, the better. And I think it's also really critical that we don't just communicate, sort of talk at people, but actually invite people to be stakeholders in developing engagement processes, really invite people to co-create the agenda, give them a seat at the table. And in particular, when we move into things like climate adaptation, responding to impacts, equity is a very key tenet. And on a very big picture level, though, when you're looking at the complexity of the challenge we are now, it's not just a nice to do to embrace diversity. It's actually a strategic imperative because we need a lot of different worldviews thinking together, a lot of people with different perspectives, with different ideas on how to solve this challenge to be at the table. Quickly moving to the end then, just wanted to go back to the point about the stories and the narrative and really filling in that efficacy gap with stories of hope. The transformation to clean energy, to low carbon resilient communities is absolutely underway, as you all know, but those stories are not getting out there, and we really need to start talking about what is happening, what the solutions are, and the benefits that communities are already seeing from taking these actions. So that's why I'm really excited to even have this opportunity to talk with all of you today, because I think you're in a very unique position to help be those ambassadors of solutions and what's really starting to work at a community level. Focus on culture, though, not just on politics. We can't just rely on fact-based arguments. We need to start people in that disruption step, in that first stage of change, often through an experience, a wake-up call that is not just based on a logical exchange of facts. And one way to do that is to really start looking at the role of culture, experiential learning, and other strategies to start the conversation. Some of you may have seen the research done by the United Nations Foundation recently looking at social media conversations on climate in about 16 countries around the world. And except for the US, Canada, and the UK, people are talking about climate and culture. And their response is to sing songs about it, to engage creatively, to express their concern and their emotions about this issue. And I think for many, many people who are at the beginning of the behavior change curve, it's a great place to start. Finally, I want to just end by saying it's very, very important that because of the why we must act, because of how people need to feel that emotion to get off the couch and get going, that we don't just include the facts, we don't just tell a story, but we be willing to actually include what is the moral call to action? What is this obligation that we do have around stewardship, around next generations, around community, around health, around all of those values that Liz mentioned in her presentation. And even if we're still trying to convey the science, the policy, to illustrate our expertise, that we not be afraid to also include how this issue makes us feel and why we care and why we're inspired to act. So I look very much forward to the questions and conversation, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Kara. It was a great presentation with some really good concrete, I think, examples of the steps and the phases that folks go through as they engage in behavior change, and I think we'll see a lot of that highlighted in the next presentation from Kate about what's going on in Salt Lake City. So if folks have any questions for Kara and about the work that she's, the research that she's mentioned, please go ahead and type those into the GoToWebinar control panel on your screen, and we'll get to those later in the webcast. Before we go on to our next presentation, we have another poll question for you that refers back to the 5 D's of behavior change that Kara mentioned in her presentation. So based on the audiences that you're working with, where do you see them falling in the 5 D's of behavior change, from the disinterest category to deliberation, design, doing, and defending? So folks could just take a minute to select the groups that they have been working with or that they think their target audiences are falling into that would be helpful for us. So we'll give folks a minute to put in their answers. All right, we can go ahead and pull up the results. So it looks like the most popular categories is that folks are in the deliberation phase, thinking about that they might change. And I think that's pretty common. I think the question that we're really tackling today is how do we move folks from that stage into the design, the commitment to doing, and then actually doing the changes that are being asked of them. And I think the presentation next from Kate will help provide some good examples of how to do that. So other popular groups here are in the disinterest category and the design category. So thank you very much for providing that information. And with that, we'll move on to our final presentation.